Well, I don't know if you read ahead, if you're reading through Judges with us, but for those of you that did, what do you think of the last third of Judges? It's a little rugged, not exactly light reading, pretty tragic, some a little bit hard to understand as you read through that, and hopefully it can help make some sense out of this last section of Judges. We're in Judges chapter 13 to 21 today, so we'll finish out this book. If I say Samson, what do you think? Delilah. Samson and Delilah. I expected that would be number one on your list here, huh? For most of you, Samson and Delilah. Okay, anybody else? Things that... Hair. Yeah. Your dog. My dog. Oh, that's right. We have a little dog named... Never entered my mind. Yeah, but you guys, you got to see this dog. It's just a little squatty thing. And we need to move on. Yeah. I mean... Strength. Jawbone. Okay. A lot of different things come to mind when we... Answer to prayer, he was, yeah. That's right, of his mom, prayer of his mom. Okay, good. Good things. You know, as we go through these first few chapters, we're going to deal with the man Samson and his life. You know, I read one commentator, and he described Samson as kind of that typical juvenile delinquent living out his sinful life. In many respects, that's accurate. You know, there are some things that certainly reflect that in some of the decisions and the attitudes and even actions that he demonstrated. And yet, you know, we find in this passage that God had a plan that he intended to fulfill. Unfortunately, we get so caught up, I think, in our childhood from the stories that were told about Samson that I think seldom do the stories ever really address the specific reason God was going to use Samson and what that purpose was. And so without addressing that very specific purpose that God had in mind for Samson, we get a series of stories, much of which are rather ungodly or even immoral in nature, in his pursuits and his passions, but we lose what ultimately God is accomplishing in and through the man's life, and so we're going to try to address that this morning. And then the last several chapters, there's a number of things that I think will be helpful for us to talk about to have a context to what God is doing in this book. So beginning in chapter 13, verse 1, it says, "Now the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, so that the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines 40 years. The cycle continues. The ungodly cycle continues. And so the nation of Israel oftentimes would feign obedience or feign worship, generally very short-lived, if anything. And then they're right back into that miserable succumbing to sinfulness. In verse 2 it says, "There was a certain man of Zor of the family of the Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had borne no children." And so here we get to a mom who desires a child and God's provision for her. It says in verse 3, "Then the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, 'Behold, now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and give birth to a son.'" And so you can imagine the delight of this mom in anticipation of God's provision for her. It says in verse 4, "Now therefore be careful not to drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing, for behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God." That is, one who's going to be set aside for a specific purpose. He's going to be a Nazarite to God from the womb. "And he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines." Now, there's the purpose for which Samson is on this earth. Okay? God has gone to this woman and said, "You're going to bear a child. He's going to be set apart in a unique way, a Nazarite. But he's set aside for this purpose. he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines. He's not going to finish it. He's simply going to start the process. They've been under the oppression of the Philistines because of their rebellion. And so Samson is going to be the one that God chooses to begin the process of an opposition against the Philistines. And that's going to continue on as we move into the book of 1 Samuel under the leadership of Samuel, Saul, David. We're going to see the Philistines come back and come back. And so what we have to keep in mind is God's work happens, what, over much longer periods than our lifetimes. So oftentimes we have this very narrow mentality that what happens to me is everything. We want to see life defined by what I understand of life and what God is doing in the here and now. But you folks, God is doing something here that he's going to carry on for decades after this in fulfilling his eternal plan. And frankly, Samson is just a very small part of that fulfillment. And so it's important to keep that in mind. And also keep in mind that what God starts with Samson, he's going to finish with other people. And you and I have to get used to that. That God may intend to use you to start something that he has no intent to finish with you. He can finish things any way he wants. You know, lest we become proud and think that this is all about me. And frankly, we all struggle with that in one respect or another. And so Samson's purpose, you need to understand, God's design for Samson is stated here. It's to begin deliverance for Israel from the hand of the Philistines. So now we're going to see the progression of how he does that. And he will use even the sinful pursuits, attitudes, and actions of Samson to accomplish this purpose. Now, you ask, well, why would he do that? Well, you guys, if he's going to use any of us, he's going to have to use us even in the midst of our sinfulness because we are sinners by nature. We struggle having one pure motive, frankly. You know, we can desire to do what's right, but folks, we all struggle with sin. And so it is that God uses sinful people and even their sinful decisions to ultimately accomplish his eternal purposes. Number six, you see some of the requirements for the Nazarite vow, but we're not going to spend time there. You can read that later if you would like. In verses six and following, The passage describes now this interaction between this man of God, this angel who has come, this very awesome person who has come and is having interaction. And Manoah in verse 8 entreated the Lord and said, O Lord, please let the man of God whom you have sent come to us again that he may teach us what to do for the boy who is to be born. And so you have this interaction and ultimately you get down to verse 22. Let's start, look at verse 21. The angel of the Lord did not appear to Manoah or his wife again. Then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. So Manoah said to his wife, we will surely die. Because why? This is not just an angel, for we have seen God. We have seen God. And so here it is that God is interacting with these people, with this family, to begin a work in the nation of Israel, to begin to free them from the bondage that they have been under. Now, you have to come back again, and you guys, the reality is the fact that God is still even interacting with these people is remarkable, right? Because you don't see these people repenting right here. You don't see this cry of Israel screaming for deliverance. You just see God, who has intended to work with these people, continuing to work with these people. They don't deserve it at all, nor do we. And yet God is such a gracious God. In verse 23, but his wife said to him, if the Lord had desired to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering from our hands, nor would he have shown us all these things, nor would he have let us hear things like this at this time. And so Samson is born in verse 24 of chapter 13. It says, the woman gave birth to a son and named him Samson, and the child grew up and the Lord blessed him. Why did the Lord bless him? That's it. I mean, it's simple. Because he chose to. Because he chose to. Samson's born in sin, just like you and I are born in sin. There's nothing in this passage that indicates that Samson was born and God's gone, wow, got some potential here. I mean, it was determined before his birth. In fact, so much so that he was born to a barren woman, that God was going to bless him and use him in specific ways. Again, that in no way means that Samson is not a sinful man, and we're going to see that reality, and yet God will accomplish his purpose. In fact, in verse 25, it says, "The Spirit of the Lord began to stir him." And so it is, and you'll see that phrase. You'll see the Spirit of God doing things in Samson's life to accomplish these specific objectives. Well, we get to chapter 14, verse 1, and we already have an obvious challenge. Samson went down to Timnah, and he saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. Well, you guys, the Philistines, what do we know? Why is God going to use Samson? What's his purpose? To deliver them from the Philistines. But what's Samson's first recorded act? He goes and he finds a gal from the Philistines, and he likes her. And he wants her. And you guys, in his mind, is he fulfilling God's purpose for himself? But will God use it to do exactly what he intended to do? And then Samson, in his carelessness and foolishness, will he live with some consequences for his sinfulness? Yes, that all works out perfectly in God's divine plan. Look at the attitude of this man. In verse 2, so he came back and told his father and mother. How many of y'all have kids? Okay, you know, as they grow up, you ever have that rare occasion where your kids obviously feel much more capable than they think you are? You know, and there that might be that moment where they actually challenge your leadership and your authority. Yeah? A couple of you have had that? Yeah. I mean, we're all sinners, folks. We're just all sinners, you know? And you think back when you were a kid. Yeah, never mind. Yeah. Right? Because don't we all know you can think back and say, oh God, I'm so sorry. You know, I'm so sorry. Well, here he is. He comes back and told his father and mother, I saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her for me as a wife. Demand. Again, I don't believe his intent necessarily is to fulfill God's purposes here. In fact, it seems quite contrary, and yet God is going to use it, and he states that here. It goes on in verse 3, then his father and his mother said to him, is there no woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all our people that you go to take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? But Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she looks good to me. Wow! Wow! This, you know, this rebellious, juvenile delinquent, do what I say. And yet in verse 4, however, his father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. Now, at that time, the Philistines were ruling over Israel. And here's the deal. God allows Samson to pursue his sinful, independent, arrogant way. God has set this man aside as a Nazirite to free them from the Philistines. This man determines he's going to go take a wife from the Philistines. And God is saying, in my divine plan, I'm going to use that very act. And you think, well, how does that work? You marry a gal from the Philistines. That doesn't seem like a good way to really overthrow them. But it gets ugly. It gets ugly. And it's not at all what Samson intended. But God is going to begin the overthrow. In verse 5 of chapter 14, Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother, came as far as the vineyards of Timnah, and behold, a young lion came roaring toward him. And here's where we see the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, so that he tore him as one tears a young goat, though he had nothing in his hand, but he did not tell his father or mother what he'd done. So he went down and talked to the woman, and she looked good to Samson. Verse 8, when he returned later to take her, he turned aside to look at the carcass of the lion, and behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the body of the lion. So he scraped the honey into his hands, went on eating as he went. And as the story progresses, verse 10, his father went down to the woman. Samson made a feast there for the young men, customarily did this. So he's getting ready for this wedding feast. When they saw him in verse 11, they brought 30 companions to be with him. So Samson, in his glorious moment of the wedding feast, he propounds a riddle to them. He says, if you will indeed tell it to me within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 linen wraps and 30 changes of clothes. Now, we look at 30 linen wraps, 30 changes of clothes. I mean, it seems like, what's that about? It doesn't seem like a big deal. But in this culture, you typically would only have one set of something that was really nice for an event like this. Very expensive. Something that you didn't easily come by. And so that's why the issue of the clothes, and he's going to give them this riddle. But if you are unable to tell me, then you shall give me 30 linen wraps and 30 changes of clothes. And so they said, you know, give us the riddle. Well, that's where we get into the betrayal here in verse 15. It came about on the fourth day that they said to Samson's wife. Now, here's the threat. Entice your husband so that he will tell us the riddle, or we will burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us to impoverish us? Is this not so? Okay, so now you're seeing that this little clothes thing is not a little deal. I mean, this is extremely costly. There's a lot at stake. And so they come to his wife and said, if you don't tell us what this riddle is, then we're going to burn you. You're dead. We'll get rid of you, so you better figure this out. Nothing like celebration week. Huh? I'm sure it's not what Samson intended, is he's going to go get his Philistine wife. Verse 16, Samson's wife wept before him. I'm sure that's not what he was thinking either in this week of celebration. And she says, you only hate me, and you do not love me. You have propounded a riddle to the sons of my people and have not told it to me. And he said to her, behold, I have not told it to my father or mother, so should I tell it to you? Marital conflict. You know, parents, wives, husbands, you know, can get pretty dicey. However, she wept before him 7 days while their feast lasted. On the seventh day, he told her because she pressed him so hard. She then told the riddle to the sons of her people. So the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, what is sweeter than honey and what is stronger than a lion? He said to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he went down to Ashkelon and killed 30 of them and took their spoil and gave the changes of clothes to those who told the riddle, and his anger burned, and he went up to his father's house. And so here in this process, folks, while Samson is just going to go and really create an alliance by marrying a Philistine woman, God uses that very event to get Samson to begin this process of opposing the Philistines. Because so far, the Israelites have tolerated the situation with the Philistines in the land, and they've been oppressed by them. And so, again, not turning out at all like Samson intended, accomplishing exactly what God was going to accomplish. In verse 20, it says, but Samson's wife was given to his companion who has been his friend. Now, this is where this gets kind of dicey, because this doesn't end on a very good note. So Samson goes out and kills a bunch of people and gets these clothes and pays his debt and then takes off. Well, this gal's father thinks, well, that's it. It's all over. So he gives her to one of Samson's friends. But Samson comes back. And he's coming back thinking she's still his wife. And everything's as it ought to be. But it's obviously not the way that it needs to be. So in verse 1, after a while, in the time of wheat harvest, Samson visited his wife with a young goat and said, I will go into my wife in her room. But her father did not let him enter. Her father said, I really thought you hated her intensely, so I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister more beautiful than she? I don't know that the wife would have appreciated that. But let her be yours instead. Can you imagine that moment? And again, see, Samson's kind of going his way, but God is going to turn the circumstances in such a way to accomplish his purpose. In verse 3, Samson then said to them, this time I shall be blameless in regard to the Philistines when I do them harm. Samson went and caught 300 foxes, and then it says he took torches, turned the foxes tail to tail and put one torch in the middle between the two tails. That could be either foxes or jackals, the same word. When he had set fire to the torches. He released them into the standing grain of the Philistines, thus burning up both the shocks and the standing grain along with the vineyards and the growth. So you can imagine, this is devastating to these folks. Philistines have been in control. Philistines have been oppressing the Israelites. Now you have one man that God uses to stir it up. And he uses all of these animals and sends fire through the grain. And you guys, we don't think a lot of that. But when we, if we could come to grips with how easy it will be when God wants to shut down a country. You know, like we, there's this sense of the United States is, you know, it's just such a power and dominating. You guys, if God wants to shut it down here, he can do it overnight. He really could. And in a situation like this, you just wipe out the grain, just like you can wipe out a half billion eggs. You know, any of you paying attention to the news, you know, a half a billion eggs now may have salmonella, you know. I mean, the whole idea is, you guys, when you cut off a food supply, you can wipe out a people. You can just wipe them out. So Samson starts a war by doing this. Verse 7, Samson said to them, since you act like this, I will surely take revenge on you. But after that, I will quit. And so he struck them with a great, great slaughter. Oh, verse 6, you need to look at that. Remember when the Philistines threatened to burn her if she didn't tell them the story? Well, that was in 14:15. In 15, verse 6, it says, then the Philistines said, who did this? And they said, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he took his wife and gave her to his companion. So the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. They did what they threatened to regardless. So Samson then took revenge and he slaughtered many. It was a ruthless slaughter. In verse 9, the Philistines went up and camped in Judah. Those would be people of God spread out in Lehi. The men of Judah said, why have you come up against us? And they said, we have come up to bind Samson in order to do him as he did to us. So the 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Edom and said to Samson, do you not know that the Philistines are rulers over us? What then is this that you have done to us? And he said to them, as they did to me, so I have done to them. They said to him, we have come down to bind you so that we may give you into the hands of the Philistines. And Samson said to them, swear to me that you will not kill me. So they said to him, no, but we will bind you fast and give you into their hands, yet surely we will not kill you. Then they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. So here, see, the Israelites still want, you know, the Philistines are in control here. Don't stir it up. The Israelites don't want Samson to stir it up. But God said, I'm going to begin the process of overthrowing the Philistines. So here you have all of his own people come to take him captive, to lead him to the Philistines. And that's when we had somebody said earlier, talked about the jawbone of a donkey in verse 14 of chapter 15. When he came to Lehi, the Philistines shouted as they met him, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily. There it is again. So that the ropes that were on his arms were as flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds dropped from his hands. He found a fresh jawbone of a donkey, so he reached out and took it and killed 1,000 men with it. Then Samson said, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I've killed 1,000 men. Wow. Verse 18 shows that we're all very vulnerable. Then he became, that is Samson, very thirsty, and he called to the Lord and said, you have given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant, and now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised? I think there's a good lesson for us. Here's Samson. He achieves an incredible feat. One man kills 1,000. One man kills 1,000. But you guys, shortly after that, he knows if God doesn't spare his life, he's going to die. And why? Because he doesn't have something to drink. That's how vulnerable we are. That's how vulnerable you it's so easy for us to feel secure and feel like we're in control and that life is just going to keep going as it is. But you guys, we are so vulnerable. We're so vulnerable. In a moment of time, all that we need, desperately need, just to sustain life could be taken away. But we live oftentimes as though it's always going to be there and we just deserve it to be there. So here God takes this man who just has this great victory and reminds him that except I give you a cup of water, you would die. You would die. and yet God kindly sustains him. Judges chapter 16. Samson went to Gaza and he saw a harlot there. And he went into her. We're seeing a pattern here with Samson, aren't we? When it was told to the Gazites, saying, Samson has come here, they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. And they kept silent all night, saying, let us wait until morning light, then we will kill him. Now Samson lay until midnight, and at midnight he arose and took hold of these doors, big doors, of the massive doors of the city gate, and the two posts, pulled them up along with the bars. Then he put them on his shoulders and carried them up to the top of the mountain, which is opposite Hebron, somewhere around 38 miles. Impressive. Yeah. God had given him incredible strength. And then in verse 4, after this, it came about that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was... This is what everybody thinks about with Samson, right? Delilah. You guys, he had other episodes already of sinful pursuits that had caused him great grief. And oftentimes, again, in this series of stories, we fail to understand that everything God is doing with Samson has to do with beginning a battle, a war against the Philistines, to create a deliverance for Israel in the decades to come. So he loves this woman, it says. The lords of the Philistines came up to her and said to her, entice him. Boy, does this bring back memories? Here we go again. Tells her, entice him. See where his great strength lies and how we may overpower him, that we may bind him to afflict him. Then we will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver. There's five rulers of the Philistine. Huge sum, approximately 30 pounds each. So Delilah said to Samson, please tell me where your great strength is and how you may be bound to afflict you. I mean, what a question. I mean, tell us how we can really hurt you. I mean, that's what she's saying. That's a wife you want. What could I do to you to really make your life miserable? I mean, isn't that's what she's saying, guys? But that's how foolish that we can be. That's how ignorant we can be. And so she asked him that, and then he lies to her on three different occasions. He gives her three reasons. She tries them. They don't work. I mean, and it's obvious what she's trying to do. But in verse 15, she said to him, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? And again, this is just the absolute perversion of what love even is. I mean, she's trying to find out something in order to destroy him, and yet she speaks of love. Well, folks, I worked in youth ministry for almost 30 years. And it's so sad at different times to see kids who are pursuing a path that was so clearly contrary to God's purposes. So clearly contrary. But isn't it easy when we just determine to go away to justify it every single way we can? And then the consequences are so very real. They're just so real and so tragic. And so in this case, he finally tells his secret. In telling his secret, the Nazarite vow has been broken. God set him aside from his womb with a Nazarite vow. And his willingness to give that information violates that vow. And so in verse 20, when she said, the Philistines are upon you, Samson, he awoke from his sleep and said, I will go out as at other times and shake myself free. But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. So it's all done. His strength was not inherent within himself. His strength was only from God. And so to violate what God said, what God had commanded, meant in this case that God's power was no longer going to be available to him, or at least for a time. They torture him. Chapter 16, verse 21. The Philistines seized him, gouged out his eyes. They brought him down to Gaza and bound him with bronze chains, and he was a grinder in the prison. However, the hair of his head began to grow again after it was shaved off. Now the lords of the Philistines assembled to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon their god, and to rejoice, for they said, our God has given Samson, our enemy, into our hands. Well, actually, it wasn't their God at all, was it? It was Samson's God who did that. Samson's God allowed that to happen. Verse 24, when the people saw him, they praised their God, for they said, "Our God has given our enemy into our hands, even the destroyer of our country, who has slain many of us." It so happened when they were in high spirits that they said, "Call for Samson that he may amuse us." So they called for Samson from the prison, and he entertained them. And they made him stand between the pillars. Then Samson said to the boy who was holding his hand, "Let me feel the pillars on which the house rests, that I may lean against them." Now the house was full of men and women, and all the lords of the Philistines were there. About 3,000 men and women were on the roof looking while Samson was amusing them. And then in verse 28, a key verse, Samson called to the Lord and said, "O Lord God, please remember me and please strengthen me just this time, O God, that I may at once be avenged of the Philistines for my two eyes." Samson's last solemn prayer, a commentator named Kandel says, in which he uses three different titles for God, Adonai, Yahweh, and Elohim, was her strength that vengeance might be taken on his persecutors. Oh, Lord God, please remember me and strengthen me this one time. And so Samson grasped the two middle pillars on which the house rested and braced himself against them, the one with his right hand and the other with his left. And Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." And he bent with all his might so that the house fell on the lords and all the people who were in it. So the dead whom he killed at his death were more than those whom he killed in his life. Then his brothers and all his father's household came down, took him, brought him up and buried him. It says he judged Israel. His father, he had judged Israel for 20 years. Wow. Wow. Quite a life, huh? From the very beginning, God said, "This is what I'm going to accomplish through this man." This man, he made choices that were clearly opposed to biblical priorities, biblical standards, biblical principles. But even in that, God says, "I'm going to use even the very relationship he establishes with a Philistine woman. I'm going to use that to begin the overthrow of the Philistines." And then Samson progresses through these relationships to the point where he violates his Nazirite vow. They gouge his eyes out. And God takes a blind man and gives him strength for one last act. And that was that final part of Samson's purpose in life, to begin the overthrow of the Philistine nation. And so he brings those pillars down. So it's really all about the beginning of this overthrow. And that's how God used Samson, even in his sinful choices, because God is God. And so, folks, we look around and it's hard for us to even comprehend how God can use sinful choices, sinful things. Well, the reality is we're all sinful. And there's nothing that God cannot take and bring his purposes from it. And boy, it's costly. There's some hard things that happen in this story. Hard things. You think about this girl and her dad being burned. And there's hard things. But you guys, that's what sin creates. And so some tragic events as we come to the book, into the book of Judges. Chapter 17 to 21, kind of considered appendices. You know, there's some now kind of descriptions of some events that are pretty interesting. It's strange in many respects. There's no suggestions of foreign domination. There are no judges. There's no king. In fact, it says every man did what was right in his own eyes. But there are stories that tell us a lot about what a culture becomes like when they choose to walk in a manner that is not pleasing to the Lord. And so some things that I think can be helpful for us to understand as we work through this. In chapter 17, verse 1, it says, "Now there was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah. He said to his mother, 'The 1,100 pieces of silver which were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse in my hearing, behold, the silver is with me. I took it.' And his mother said, 'Blessed be my son by the Lord.'" Right, now you're going to have to stay with this story. You can get lost and where this whole thing is going. Then he returned the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother, and his mother said, I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to the Lord, for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. Now, therefore, I will return them to you. So when he returned the silver to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave them to the silversmith, who made them into a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod, a garment, and a household had household idols, and he consecrated one of his sons that he might become the priest. You just have to get your arms around the fact how perverted the culture has become. Okay, you need to understand how, first of all, he steals from his mom. And she offers a curse, no doubt intentionally saying it loud enough so he could hear what the curse was. And when she gives this curse, he comes and responds, I took it, here it is back. And then they're going to make these gods, these idols, these household things. Not only that, but Micah takes his own son and consecrates his son to be his priest. Now, you guys, who's supposed to be the priest at this time? The Levites. Yeah, they're designated people, and there's designated cities, and there's designated responsibilities. There's designated ways to worship. And now, all of a sudden, you see this storyline revolving around this man and his mom, and now these graven images and this form of worship, even taking his own son and determining, my son is going to be my priest in the house. In verse 6, it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Is that not a theme even when we go back to the beginning of time in Genesis? Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Now in verse 7, it says, there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite. And he was staying there. Okay, now we've got a Levite coming into the picture. And the Levite, they're supposed to be designated cities, right? They're supposed to be provided for. And then they're supposed to help maintain the spiritual priorities of the nation. The man departed from the city, from Bethlehem and Judah, to stay wherever he might find a place. And as he made his journey, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. And Micah said to him, where do you come from? He said to him, I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to stay wherever I may find a place. This is perfect. Here I've been using my son as a priest. How much better if I had a Levite to be the priest in my home? Wouldn't that be great? Micah said to him, dwell with me. Be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, a suit of clothes, and your maintenance. So the Levite went in. The Levite agreed to live with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, now I know the Lord will prosper me, seeing I have a Levite as a priest. See what's going on? All right. Folks, in our culture, in what ways do people use Christian-type things as good luck charms? Could be a cross around your neck. What are things that people do in our culture that use spiritual things like their good luck charms? If I just do this, God is going to be happy and God is going to bless me, or God is going to provide for me, or God is going to let me have that baby or adopt that, or God is going to let me have good health. What are the things that we do? If I just pray. Start going to church. If I go to church faithfully, surely God will let that happen. Give money. Give money to charity. If I read my Bible. I mean, how many times, you know, you're kind of going along and all of a sudden crisis hits and you get it out. And are we getting it out because we know we need to draw close to God? Or are we getting it out because we're just trying to manipulate God to get what we want? Is it really accepting God's plan and purpose for my life, regardless, understanding that could be very hard things? Or is it to get what I want my purpose in life to be from God? See, those are hard things. Any one of us, you guys, can fall into that pattern of trying to manipulate God to get what we want. And see, this is a religious game that they're playing right now. And they're doing it by having these household idols. And he had his own priest. Now he's got this Levite that's going to be his priest. And so feels pretty satisfied with the way things are going. Well, in those days, in chapter 18, those days there was no king in Israel. And in those days, the tribe of the Danites were seeking an inheritance for themselves to live in because they had some problems, some struggles. And so they're out looking for a place where they can have get some land. And in their travels, they come to Micah's house. And they hear the Levite, and they hear it, and they recognize him. In verse 3, they recognize the voice of the young man, the Levite. They turned aside there and said to him, Who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What do you have here? And so he explains to them. They said to him, Inquire of God, please, that we may know whether our way which we're going will be prosperous. Now, you guys, they use the name of God in these passages, but you have to just understand that there's no indication of a relationship with God in these chapters. There's clear sinfulness, selfishness, a priest that's using household idols. In verse 6, the priest said to them, Go in peace. Your way in which you're going has the Lord's approval. So they go. Works out good for them. Works out good. You guys, again, pragmatism. Just because it works, does it make it right? Of course not. Of course not. And so, anyways, they find land. They go back and they get their a bunch of men to go to battle, take 600 of them. As they're going back to take the land, they come through to where Micah's house is, and they decide, you know, that Levite, he did a good job for us. He said, go, and we went. We found the land. This is good. So what are we going to do? Well, let's steal the priest. So they ask Micah, hey, you want to come with us? And so they take him. So they can have their priest now. So they take Micah. I mean, is this just absolutely sick? They take him and they take off with the priest. And Micah and his guys, they chase after him. But it was very obvious when they got there that they were outnumbered terribly. And so they were not able to get their priest back. Name of that priest, the Levite in verse 30, is Jonathan. Come to Judges 19. Now it came about in those days, here's another story, when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judah. But his concubine played the harlot against him, and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah, and there was there for a period of 4 months. And so again, now you're getting into this strange deal. A concubine is not your wife, can be treated like a slave. Sometimes if your wife's barren, you take a concubine, then you can have children, because all that was very important but not biblically right. But that's what he's done, and she leaves, and she's unfaithful. They're separated for a period of months. In verse 3, her husband arose and went after her to speak tenderly to her in order to bring her back. Well, that goes pretty good. They stay in the father's house for a while, seem to have a pretty good relationship. It's time to go, but he doesn't want them to go, and so they stay a little bit longer, a little bit longer, a little bit longer. Finally, they say, we've got to go. It's time to leave. So they take off. As they're traveling back, in verse 11 of chapter 19, when they're near Jebus, it says the day was almost gone, and the servant said to his master, please come, let us turn aside into this city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it. However, his master said to him, we will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who are not of the sons of Israel. We're going to go on as far as Gibeah. So that's what they do. Gibeah, in verse 14, belongs to Benjamin. And so they go to this city, and it's their own people in the city. And they wait in the square at the street where they would expect to be invited into a home, and nobody invites them in. Well, over time, an old man comes in the city who also lives there, foreigner, but he comes and he lives there, and he invites them to come into his home. And so they go into the home, but in verse 22 it says, while they were celebrating, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, surrounded the house, pounding the door, and they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came into your house so that we may have relations with him. This takes us back to where? Sodom and Gomorrah, when a culture just becomes totally perverted in the way they live and the way they act. And so you have that same picture, don't you? And these men out there who are absolutely wicked. And folks, you know, as our culture goes on, well, there's big, big problems. Because what God defines as sinful, our culture defends as being appropriate. Even now, the church culture defends. And we're going to see that. That goes right back to here. That happened long ago, the defense of gross immorality. And God says, no. Well, this is so tragic, these events. Referred to in Hosea chapter 9 and 10, but in 19:23 of this book it says, the man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said to them, no, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not commit this act of folly. Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Please let me bring them out that you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish. But do not commit such an act of folly against this man. You guys realize how sick that is? How absolutely perverted and warped from the people inside the house as well as the people outside the house. That's how bad the sin has become. When the men would not listen to him, in verse 25, the man seized his concubine, brought her out to them, and they raped her and abused her all night until morning, then let her go at the approach of dawn. And so at the approach of dawn, apparently the man slept. Certainly he didn't go out and check on anybody. The woman came and fell down at the door of the man's house where master was until full daylight. Nobody went out early to check. Nothing. When her master rose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, then behold, his concubine was lying at the doorway. Surprise! Huh? I mean, is this not just sick? And so he picks her up, carries her back, and when he gets home, you've heard this sick story. When he entered his house, in verse 29, he took a knife and laid hold of his concubine, cut her into 12 pieces limb by limb, and he sent her throughout the territory of Israel. And he uses that to appeal to people to come and rally the troops to go fight against the Benjamites because they were not willing to deal with the worthless, gross, sinful things that were going on in their town. And yet, you guys, this is like the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, this is a man who was willing to push his concubine, the one he went after because he tenderly cared for her, and yet pushed her out the door to be brutalized and murdered. And now he comes back, and if you're not careful in reading this, you can think that somehow this is a good thing that he's doing. You guys, this whole thing is bad from the beginning. This shows how grossly sinful the entire nation had become. That's what it shows. So he sent that out, and you guys, the people came. 400,000 people come. And they come to rally against Benjamin to deal with the sinful people. And they gave him a chance to deal with them, and the Benjamites said no. They defended the sinful actions of those men. They would not deal with them. And so they said, fine, then there's going to be a war. Now, in chapter 20, verse 18, it says, the sons of Israel arose, went up to Bethel, and they inquired of God and said, who shall go up first for us to battle against the sons of Benjamin? The Lord said, Judah shall go up first. Now, I want you to get the picture here. You can get confused. Okay, so now we've got the Israelites. They've come together, and they're coming in opposition to Benjamin, and they're going to punish him. And so they all come together with this mass of troops. And they ask God, who goes first? And he says, Judah, the tribe of Judah goes first. And so they say, okay, they rise in the morning. They go out against them. Israel went out to battle against Benjamin. In verse 20, the men of Israel arrayed for battle against them at Gibeah. Then the sons of Benjamin came out of Gibeah and fell to the ground on that day. 22,000 men of Israel. The Israelites ask God, who should go first? God says, Judah. So they go out to the battle, and what happens? They lose. 22,000 men die. The Israelites come back, I'm sure, bewildered. Why did this happen? And so it says, the people, the men of Israel, encouraged themselves, arrayed for battle again in the place where they had arrayed themselves the first day. The sons of Israel went up, and they wept before the Lord until evening, and inquired of the Lord, saying, shall we again draw near for battle against the sons of my brother Benjamin? And the Lord said, go up against them. Now, I want you to know that both of these times, God never said you're going to win, but he said, go up. And so they do. This time, Benjamin wins and kills 18,000 men of the sons of Israel. So now we have more men killed of the Israelites than there even were of the Benjamites. But you say, well, what's this about? Well, as it continues, it says, then all the sons of Israel and all the people went up and came to Bethel and wept. Thus they remained there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening, and they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. The sons of Israel inquired of the Lord. This is the third time, for the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, Aaron's son, stood before it to minister in those days, saying, shall I yet again go out to battle against the sons of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease? And the Lord said, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand. You know what, folks? Here's the deal. They were all living in sin. The Benjamites, but all of them. All of them were living in sin. And so the Israelites, they come with their massive army to go in and they're going to deal with the sin of the Benjamites. But God was bringing them up short to make them realize that they also were not in right relationship with God. And so they come the first time, should we go? And who goes first? Judah. They come back crying the next time. Should we go? Should we drop? Yeah, go ahead. The next time when they come, they're crying and they're sacrificing and they're now beginning to bow before God. Instead of just using him as their good luck charm, they're beginning to understand the power of God and the purposes of God. And he's not simply to be used to accomplish what we want. And you guys, sometimes it's easier to see somebody else's sin, isn't it, than to deal with our own. And there was sin all through the camp. And so God was intentional in dealing with it. And then they went and they had this great battle. And it says in verse 35, the Lord struck Benjamin before Israel. So the sons of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin that day. And so God did bring judgment against Benjamin. But folks, what you have to understand is this whole thing from beginning to end is just a tragic result of the people of God choosing to live in sinful ways, defend sinful behaviors, and think that God is somehow going to be okay with that. And then to think that, well, God's going to use us to destroy them because they're worse than we are. They learned that they better come to grips with who God is, period. The rest of the passage, as it progresses, you can imagine now they've almost destroyed this whole tribe of Benjamin. And now there's concern that there needs to be a tribe of Benjamin. We've killed all of these people, and they're going to be without a tribe. And so there was mourning. The problem is they'd have made a covenant that if we come out against them, we're going to destroy them. We're not going to give our wives to them. And so now they're saying, if we don't give them wives, the tribe is going to die off. But we can't just give them wives, because that would then violate the covenant that we made, and we're going to be in trouble. And so, remember, they said that anybody who does not go out with us from our people to go destroy them, then we're going to go attack them. Well, Jabesh-Gilead didn't go out. So they decided, they started thinking, who didn't come? Who wasn't here? Who wasn't here? No, Jabesh-Gilead wasn't here. So they said, well, let's go attack them, and then we'll take a bunch of their virgin daughters. Okay, they got 400 daughters there, and so they're still a couple hundred short. It gets convoluted, doesn't it, when we pursue patterns of sin. All right. And so they got 400. They needed a couple hundred more. But now they can't just give the wives away. So they say, there's a big celebration at Shiloh once a year. So when that celebration is going on, that's Israelites. They're going to be there having this great celebration. They told then the Benjamites, you need to go there. And when you see a young virgin that you want to be your wife, just grab her and run. And then, of course, the people of Shiloh are saying, now, wait a minute. And they said, here's the deal. They need to have wives. If we give them wives, then we're going to be condemned because we broke our covenant. But if they take them and we simply don't try to stop them, then they took them. We didn't give them, but it accomplishes what we need. It just goes on and on. But anyways. But see, that if you step back, the problem is with these passages, if you just read a little bit at a time, you get lost in it. I mean, you just get lost and you can say, what is going on? I mean, because you might feel like God is honoring something over here and not, you know, but when you step back and you look at the big picture, you just see the whole thing is a result of godless behavior, and God is bringing judgment. It all started early with Samson stirring things up, and we're going to see that continue. But here then we see some episodes in the course of things that remind us of how ugly sin gets. Now, folks, when we step back from our own country, we can see that there's a growing tolerance of sin, a growing acceptance of sin. There's a growing toleration of allowing people to be in the pulpit, as Tom was saying this morning, that are living lives that are absolutely contrary, even as these worthless fellows are called, because they're living immoral lives and yet representing themselves is chosen by God, used of God. Well, you just have to know that God only lets that go for a time. And he will use his means, whether it be us or others or other ways or any phenomenon he wants. He will not tolerate it. He won't tolerate it in our lives if we simply choose to wink at it and excuse it. And he won't tolerated in our country, he's not going to tolerate it in the world. His patience right now is for the sake of the proclamation of the gospel, that people can come to know him. And when he's done, he's going to be done. And you can see here, he can turn one nation against another. He can send 400 against 400,000 against 27,000, and the 400,000 can lose. God has no problem. And it ought to bring us to our knees to remember that God, his holiness, righteousness, providence, sovereignty is not a joke. It's not a joke. And it should humble us to the point we get on our knees and recognize, boy, it's easier to see other people sin than my own. God, help me. Oh, help me not to be like that. Help me to see my sin, my walk. Help me to see you as I need to see you, God. Help me to stand up for those things that would please and honor you. God, don't let me become so a part of my culture that I blend in ways that would so clearly dishonor you. The whole nation in trouble. God used Samson, it's amazing, one man to stir up, if you will, a bit of a revolution that's going to continue now as we move. Well, we're going to go to Ruth, which would be very refreshing in many ways and encouraging next week. Judges is a little rough. And then we're going to move into 1 Samuel and see the last judge and then move into the first king. So let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. I thank you for your kindness and giving to us the truth of your word so that we can look and learn and understand, one, how sinful we are as a people, how holy you are as our God, and what you desire and in fact require. Heavenly Father, I pray that you'd help each one of us to be so much more alert to our own sin. Lord, might we be courageous in standing up for those things that truly please and honor you. Heavenly Father, I pray that as we watch even in our own country, we see things happen that 20 years ago we just wouldn't have dreamed possible. In the midst of it, God, help us not to be discouraged in the sense of distressed, but Lord, might it motivate us to share your love, to share the gospel, to help people to know that, God, that you can take people in the most dire, sinful circumstances and can absolutely transform their lives. Lord, help us to be purposeful in that respect. I pray in Christ's name. Amen.